brain rot you get from meth, Lucas said. Do you have a plan? Lincoln asked. I plan to spend some time with him today, just watching. Amelia and Lily can help out, see what he does, who he talks to, where he hangs out. Do we know where he lives? Lincoln asked. We do, Lily said. Lincoln said to Lucas, I wonder if the women could handle the surveillance and keep you informed, of course. Lucas said, No reason they couldn't, I guess. Easier with three of us. Why? I have an idea, but I want to speak to you privately about it just to avoid the inevitable question of conspiracy. Oh, shit, Lily said. Well, now, here's a pretty. Tasty, this one. Oh, he could picture her on her back, arms outstretched. Yeah. Lying on something rough, concrete or wood or metal. Metal's always good. Sweat on her forehead, sweat on her tits. Sweat everywhere, mewing, gasping, pleading. For a luscious moment, every other person in the club vanished from James Robert Verlaine's consciousness as his eyes, his artist's eyes, lapped up the brunette in black at the end of the bar. Tasty. Raven hair tinting from red to blue to green to violet in the spotlights. Disco decor, punk music. Rastas could never make up its mind. Hair. That aspect of the human form fascinated him. A sculptor of hard materials, he could reproduce flesh and organ, but hair remained ever elusive. She glanced toward him once, no message in the gaze, but then a second time, which was possibly a message in itself. Studying her more closely now, the oval face, the sensuous figure, the provocative way she leaned against the bar as she carried on a conversation on her cell phone, it irritated him that her attention was now on some asshole a mile or 10 miles or 100 miles away. A smile, but not at Verlaine. Mona Lisa, he reflected. That's who she reminded him of. Not a compliment, of course. Da Vinci's babe was a smirky bitch, and Lord knew the painting was way overrated. Hey, look over here, Mona. But she didn't. Verlaine flagged down the bartender and ordered. Like always, here or at one of the other clubs where he hung out, Verlaine drank bourbon, straight, because girls liked it when men drank liquor that wasn't ruined with fruit juice. Beer was for kids, wine for the bedroom after fucking. Mona looked in his direction once again, but didn't lock eyes. He was getting angry now. Who the hell was she talking to? Another scan. Little black dresses were a coward's choice, worn by women afraid to make a statement. But in Mona's case, he forgave her. The silk plunged and hovered just where it ought to, and the cloth clung like latex paint to her voluptuous figure. And what hands! Long fingers tipped in black nails. Hair was tough to duplicate, but hands were the most arduous of sculptor's challenges. Michelangelo was a genius at them, finding perfect palms and digits and nails in the heart of marble. And James Robert Verlaine, who knew he was an artistic, if not blood descendant, of the great master, created the same magic, though with metal, not stone, which was much, much tougher to accomplish. The crowd in Rastas, Midtown, was typical for this time of night. Artsy sorts who were really ad agency account managers, nerds who were really artists, hipsters pathetically clinging to their fading youth like a life preserver, players from Wall Street. Packed already. Soon to be more packed. Finally, he caught Mona's eye. Her gaze flickered. Could be flirt. Could be fuck off. But Verlaine doubted the latter. He believed she liked what she saw. Why wouldn't she? He had a lean, wolfish face, which looked younger than his 40 years. His hair a mop, thick and inky. He worked hard to keep the dew in a state of controlled unruliness. His eyes were as focused as lasers. Thin hips encased in his trademark black jeans, tight. His work shirt was DKNY, but suitably flecked and worn. The garment was two buttons undone, with the pecs just slightly visible. Verlaine humped ingots and bars of metal around his studio in the junkyards where he bought his raw materials, carried oxygen and propane and acetylene tanks, too. Another glance at Mona. He was losing control as that familiar feeling rippled through him from chest to crotch. Picking up his Basil Hayden's, he pushed away from the bar to circle Mona's way. He tried to get past a knot of young businessmen in suits. They ignored him. Verlaine hated people like this. He detested their conformity, their smugness, their utter ignorance of culture. They'd judge art by the price tag. Verlaine bet he could wipe his ass with a canvas, spray some varnish on it, and set a reserve price of $100,000, and Philistines like this would fight to outbid themselves at Christie's.
La du merde.
He pushed through the young men.
Hey, one muttered. Asshole, you spilled my...
Verlaine turning fast, firing off a searing gaze like a spurt of pepper spray. The businessman, though taller and heavier, went still. His friend stirred but chose not to come to his defense, returning quickly to a stilted conversation about the game. When it was clear Mr. Brooks Brothers wasn't going to do something stupid and get a finger or face broken, or worse, Verlaine gave him a condescending smile and moved on. Easing up to Mona, Verlaine hovered. He wasn't going to play the let's ignore each other game. He was too worked up for that. He whispered, I've got one advantage over who you're talking to. A nod at the phone. She stopped speaking and turned to him. Verlaine grinned. I can buy you a drink, and he can't. Tense. Would she balk? Mona looked him over. Slow. Not smiling now. She said into the phone, Gotta go. Click. His index finger crooked for the bartender. So, I'm James. Playing it coy, of course. She said something. He couldn't hear. The music at Rasta's was a 100-decibel remix of groups from 20 years ago, the worst of CBGBs. He leaned closer and smelled a luscious floral scent rising from her skin. Man, he wanted her. Wanted her tied down. Wanted her sweating. Wanted her crying.
What's that? He called. Mona shouted, I said, so what do you do, James?
Of course, this was Manhattan. That was always question number one.
I'm a sculptor.
Yeah? A faint Brooklyn lilt. He could tolerate that. The skepticism in her eyes, no. His iPhone appeared, and shoving it her way, he flipped through the pictures.
Jesus, you really are.
Then Mona looked past him. He followed her gaze and saw a tall redhead smiling as she made her way through the crowd. A stunner. His eyes did the triplet glance, face, tits, ass, and he didn't care that she saw him doing it. As tasty as Mona. And no LBD for her. Leather miniskirt, fishnets, low-cut dark blue sequin top, strapless. The arrivee tossed her beautiful hair off her shoulders, glistening with sweat. She cheek-kissed Mona, then pitched a smile Verlaine's way. Mona said,
This is James. He's a real sculptor. He's famous.
Cool, the redhead said, eyes wide and impressed, just the way he liked the pretties to be. He shook their hands.
And you are? He asked the redhead. I'm Amelia.
Mona turned out to be Lily. Verlaine got Amelia a Pinot Gris and a refill of his bourbon. Conversation wandered. Protocol demanded that, and Verlaine had to play the game a little longer before he could bring up the subject. You had to be careful. You could ruin an evening if you moved too fast. A girl by herself, you got her drunk enough, you could usually get her to try something different back at your place without too much effort. But two together? That took a lot more work. In fact, he wasn't sure he could pull this one off. They seemed, fuck it, smart, savvy. They weren't going to fall for lines like, I can open up a whole new world for you. No, may have to write this evening off. Hell. But just then Lily leaned forward and whispered,
So, what are you into, James?
Hobbies, you mean? He asked. The women regarded each other and broke out in laughs.
Yeah, hobbies. You have any hobbies?
Sure, who doesn't?
If we tell you about our hobby, will you tell us about yours?
When a sultry raven-haired pretty in a tight LBD asks you that question, there's only one answer.
You bet.
The redhead reached into her tiny purse and displayed a pair of handcuffs.
Okay. Maybe the night was going to be easier than he thought.
James Robert Verlaine had a certain charm, Amelia Sachs gave him that. The clothes were weird. Midnight Cowboy meets Versace, and he probably owned more hair products than she did, but despite that, his witty attention was completely on her and Lily. With Lincoln Rhyme as a romantic as well as professional partner, Amelia had been freed from the madness of the dating world. But before him, there'd been innumerable evenings in restaurants and bars with men who were anything but present. Their thoughts kept zipping back to Nokias or Blackberries in jacket pockets, to business deals sitting on office desktops, to girlfriends or wives they'd forgotten to mention. A woman knows right away when a man's with her or not. And Jim Bob, she loved Lucas Davenport's nick for him, definitely was. His sniper eyes bored into theirs. He touched arms. He asked questions, made jokes. He inquired. Of course, this wasn't typical bar meeting talk about family and exes, about the Mets, the Knicks, politics, and the latest retreads from Hollywood. No, the theme for tonight was such esoterica as describing the type of rope he enjoyed tying girls up with, where to get the best mouth gags, and what kind of whips and canes caused the most pain but left the fewest marks. Back at Lincoln's loft, the four investigators had decided the way to Verlaine's psyche was through his fly. His sadosexual history would give them entry. Lily had gone to the bar first, strategizing that a single bulb might draw the moth less suspiciously. Yep, on that one. Then Amelia, in an outfit she'd had to purchase an hour earlier, had arrived to seal the deal, and it had taken a whole 60 seconds to find out that Verlaine usually came to Rasta's before heading to his fave S&M dives. Thank you, Facebook. Verlaine's phone appeared again, and he punched in a passcode. A private photo album opened, and he leaned forward to show off his prize shots. Amelia struggled not to show her disgust. She heard Lily inhale fast, but the senior detective turned the sound into a whisper of admiration. Verlaine missed her dismay. The first image was of a naked woman, wearing only a necklace, blindfolded, with her hands taped or tied behind her. She was kneeling on a slab of concrete. Interesting, Amelia thought, and caught Lily's eye. Concrete, just like the victims. The woman in the picture had been crying. Her makeup had run to her chin, and her breasts were streaked with ugly welts. Verlaine, obviously aroused, eagerly scrolled through more images, which Amelia found increasingly hard to look at. It took all her willpower to appear aroused by the images of cruelty. He gave a running narrative of the partners. Amelia only heard the word victims. 10 minutes, 15. At that point, Verlaine said, "Excuse me, ladies, I need to run to the little boy's room. Behave while I'm away, or not." He laughed. "Back in a sec." "Wait," Lily said. Verlaine turned. "Always wondered something." He lifted an eyebrow. "What's the plural of sec?" "That son of a bitch," Lily said. She wasn't smiling. "God, that was awful," Amelia added. "What do you think?" She was nodding back toward the toilets where Jim Bob might be emptying his bladder, but was sure to be filling his nostrils. "Sleazy, scummy, I want to take a shower and hand sanitizer." "Agreed, but is he a killer?" "Those pictures," Lily whispered. "I've worked sex crimes, but that's about the worst I've seen. From some of those wounds, I guarantee he put one or two of them in the hospital." She considered the question. "Yeah, I could see him taking it a step further and killing somebody." "You?"
"I think so."
Lily continued. "I hope so. Man, I really do. I don't want the crew from Narcotics 4 to be behind this.
Amelia didn't much care for the detectives running the elite unit. Martin Glover, Danny Vincenzo, and Candy Preston all had egos like runaway stallions. But no cop wants to think that colleagues are torturing and killing wits just to up their conviction rate, however noble their cause.
Amelia looked over her friend. So, you and Lucas, you had a thing, right?
A while ago, yeah. In Minnesota, and when he came here. Really clicked between us. Still does, but not that way. We've moved on.
And you and Lincoln seem like a good fit.
Just like you were saying, it clicks. Can't explain it. Don't think about it.
Lucas has some problems with him, you know, being in the chair.
Happens some, Amelia laughed.
Of course, Lincoln rides people hard and then they get fed up and go, you're such an asshole, or fuck you. They forget he's a quad. That breaks the ice and it's all good.
With Lucas, I think it's something more. He won't talk about it.
Lily lowered her voice.
For me, I have to say, when Lucas and I met, it was... a lot of it was physical. I need that. You and Lincoln?
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not, it's good.
Different, obviously, but good.
Ah, here comes our Lord and Master.
Wiping his nose with his fingers, Verlaine was oozing his way through the crowd. Amelia was sure he turned sideways intentionally to rub against an ass or two. One of his accidental victims, a petite redhead in a leather skirt and black blouse, turned fast and eyes dark, angry disks shouted words they couldn't hear. Fast as a gun hammer falling on a primer, he wheeled and shoved his face into hers.
Christ, Amelia muttered, reaching toward her purse where a baby Glock rested. He's going to hurt her. Wait, we move in, that fucks up the whole op.
They watched closely. A cold smile blossomed on Verlaine's face as the woman looked at him warily. She was attractive and her figure was perfect, though it was clear she'd had acne in her youth or some illness that left scarring. In the space of a few seconds, as he spoke to her, still smiling coolly, her expression morphed from confused to shocked to devastated. Amelia knew he was commenting on her complexion.
He kept leaning forward, taunting, taunting, until she picked up her purse and fled into the bathroom, sobbing.
Amelia said to Lily, "His expression, what's it look like to you? Like he just fucked somebody and wants a cigarette."
Verlaine eased through the crowd back to the bar.
"Hey there, ladies. Miss me?"
The thing about burglary was, the careful burglar was rarely disturbed by the homeowner. It was always some snoopy neighbor who did him in. Lucas sat on a darkened stoop across the street from Verlaine's building, just watching and listening. The neighborhood was a tough one, not far from the East River, and not yet gentrifying. The buildings might be a little too rotten, a little too undistinguished, a little too far upriver. Verlaine's building was a bit of a puzzle. Only 2 stories tall, but wide and deep. Too large for a single inhabitant, Lucas thought. It had a shallow entrance above a wide one-step stoop with bricked-up spaces on the bottom floor that were once windows. The place could have been a hardware store at one time with walk-up apartments above it. In another neighborhood farther downtown, it would have become a nightclub or a restaurant. Here, it was just a derelict building without a single light showing, either through the barred windows on the main door or from the windows on the second floor.
Was there somebody else in there?
Verlaine himself, Lucas knew, was at a midtown bar. Nothing moving, and still Lucas waited. He'd had a little heart-to-heart with Lincoln. When the women were gone, Lincoln said, "If you go to the black cabinet by the window, in the bottom section, the left side, there's a drawer." Lucas went to the cabinet, opened a lower-level door, pulled out the drawer, and found an electric lock rake. He took it out and pulled the trigger. Dead.
"An artifact from my former life. It'll still work, but you'll have to put some AA batteries in it."
"You want me to crack Verlaine's apartment?"
"Lily said you occasionally used unconventional tactics."
Lucas said, "I'll take a look at it.
Even if this thing works, there could be other problems. Might be other people around. Locks have gotten better.
So then you don't go in, Lincoln said. I just feel it would be useful if somebody could take a preliminary look. Can't use it as evidence, of course.
Lucas nodded.
Yeah, once you know, everything else gets easier.
Then he said, look, I know I pissed you off because I was having trouble dealing with your disability.
You did.
Piss me off, Lincoln said.
Yeah, well, Lucas scratched his neck. It doesn't have anything to do with you. It's purely out of fear. This scar, he touched his neck again. A little girl shot me in the throat with a .22. Went through a coat collar, through my windpipe, got to my spine, but not into it. The kid should have killed me. She would have, but there was a doc right there, and she did a tracheotomy and kept me breathing until we got to the hospital. But if the kid had had any other kind of gun, or if the slug hadn't gone through the collar first, she would have either blown my spine out and I would have been dead on the spot, or I would have been like you. It was a matter of a quarter inch or so, or any other caliber. I look at you, and I see me.
Interesting, Lincoln said.
After the accident, did you think about suicide?
Yes, quite considerably, Lincoln said. Sometimes, I'm not sure I made the right choice staying alive, but my curiosity keeps me going. I always seem to have work. He smiled. God bless all the little criminals.
And then there's Amelia, Lucas said.
Yes, then there's Amelia.
You're a lucky man, Lincoln, Lucas said.
Lincoln laughed and said, it's been a while since anyone told me that.
After an hour on the stoop, Lucas decided that he'd either have to make a move on the building or go away. He stood up, dusted off the seat of his jeans, and saw a man walking along the sidewalk toward him alone. The man spit in the gutter and came on. When he got to Lucas, he stopped and said,
you got an extra 20?
No.
I'm not really asking, the man said.
Take a close look at me, Lucas said.
The man took a closer look, then said,
fuck you,
and went on down the street. He looked back once, then turned the corner and was gone.
Lucas waited another few minutes to see if the man came back, then crossed the street, and using his cell phone as a flashlight, looked at the lock. An old one, a good one, when it was made, but now old. With the last look around, Lucas took the rake out of his pocket, slipped the pick arm into the lock. The rake chattered for a moment as Lucas kept the turning pressure on, and then the lock went. He stepped inside, closed the door, and called, anybody home? He listened, got no response except a scrabbling sound in the ceiling. A rat.
Hey, anybody? Anybody here?
Nobody answered.
He took a flashlight from his pocket, turned it on. He was in a wide hallway with steps going up to his right and with a double door to the left. The hallway smelled of burned metal, as though somebody had been working with a welding torch. He was in the right place. He tried the double door and found it open with a bank of light switches on the wall to the left. He closed the door behind him and turned on the lights. He was in a wide-open studio with several 2-foot-tall bronze sculptures sitting on heavy wooden tables with a variety of metalworking tools, files, electric grinders, polishers, hand scribes. The air inside smelled of burned metal and polishing compound. The sculptures were all on sadomasochistic themes, nude women being whipped, bound, beaten. Just what you need to add that extra spark to your living room, Lucas thought. At the far edge of the studio was a low wooden wall, perhaps 10 feet high, which was 2 or 3 feet short of the ceiling. Behind it, Lucas found a queen-sized bed, a chest of drawers, a large closet stuffed with clothing, a bathroom, a second closet with an apartment-sized washer and dryer stacked one on top of the other, a kitchenette, and a small breakfast table with 2 chairs. A television was mounted on a swing arm at the foot of the bed. He poked through the living area for a moment, found nothing of particular interest, and continued his tour of the studio, and found, at the back,
an internal door sheathed in metal that was set in a frame a step below the rest of the floor. A door that most likely led to a basement, Lucas thought. He looked at the lock and realized that the rake wouldn't work. The thing was probably a year old, a Medico. After the quick tour of the lower floor, he turned out the lights, stepped back in the hallway, and used the flashlight to climb the stairs to the second floor. The second floor was a trash heap, a line of single rooms that had apparently last been used as a flophouse, each with a wrecked cot or a stained mattress, various pieces of mostly broken furniture. More rats. He never saw one, but he could hear them. Nothing for him there. He went back down to the studio, closed the door, turned the lights on, went to look at the cellar door again. No way to open it. It was impossible. He pounded on it a few times and listened, heard nothing. What they really needed, he thought, was behind that door, and he had no way to get there. He'd been inside for 5 or 6 minutes, and time was wearing on him. He took a plastic bag out of his pocket, and from the bag several more Ziploc-style bags, each with a white sponge-like pad in it. Lincoln's instructions had been simple enough. Press the pad into anything you'd like to pick up, then put the pad back in the plastic bag and seal it. Lucas worked his way through the studio, doing just that, sampling bronze filings from the floor, off a workbench, and out of the teeth of a metal file. Moving to the welding area, he found a selection of welding rods and stuck one of each kind in his pocket, and from a trash bin, several used rods. He sampled several stains that might possibly have been blood, but there were enough stains around the place, oil and lubricants, that he had his doubts. He was taking a sample when he saw, in a small niche off the main working space, a half dozen crucifixes on neck chains, along with a necklace of cheap aqua-colored stones, a thin string of seed pearls, a ring on a chain, and 3 sets of earrings, all pinned to the wall with tacks. And he thought, trophies? If they were, there were 12 of them. There was nothing else like them in the room. He took a half dozen photos with his cell phone. Time to leave. On his way out, he looked at each of the bronze sculptures and a clay maquette for another, and noticed that each of the women portrayed in the sculptures was wearing a single piece of jewelry of some kind, apparently to emphasize her nakedness. Was it possible that the jewelry collection did not represent trophies but was for use with models? And he was thinking about that when Lily called. He's moving. And I'm gone, Lucas said. And he thought, not for models. They were trophies, and there were 12 of them. You believe it? Lucas Davenport said, walking into the townhouse. He held up the plastic bags. This shit fell out the window when I was walking by Verlaine's apartment. Lincoln spun the motorized wheelchair around, noting eagerly, almost hungrily, the evidence in the Minnesotan's hand. Sometimes you catch a break. Anything obvious? No piles of bones or bloody shackles. There's a steel door leads somewhere, the cellar, I think. Love to see what's behind that. He explained that the lock rake wasn't up to the task, though. They'd need a warrant and a sledgehammer. Lincoln turned his attention to the evidence. Lucas dropped down into one of the wicker chairs near one of the large high-definition monitors that glowed like a billboard in Times Square. Lucas? Tom Reston, Lincoln's aide, stood in the doorway. He was a slim young man dressed in a lavender shirt, dark tie, and beige slacks. Tempt you? Beer? Anything else? Later, thanks. Lincoln said, whiskey for me. You've had 2 already, Tom countered. I'm so pleased at your sterling memory. Could I have a whiskey, please, and thank you? No. Get me. But he was speaking to an empty doorway. He grimaced. All right, let's get to work. Mel, what's in the hall? Mel Cooper looked like a geek, which he probably was, since he was the Mr. Wizard of Forensic Science on the East Coast, if not the country. The man was pale and trim and had thin hair and Harry Potter glasses that invariably slid down his nose. Pulling on gloves, a surgeon's cap, and a disposable jacket, Cooper took the bag and set the contents out on an examination pad, large sheets of sterile newsprint. Good job, he mused, looking at the carefully sealed bags. You worked crime scene before?
Nah, Lucas said, but I lost a rape-murder conviction once because some rookie tripped and dropped the perp's shoe into Medicine Lake. It was the only evidence we had that would have nailed the prick, and I had a very uncircumstantial-minded jury. The prick walked.
That hurts, Lincoln said.
Of course he went after another vic a month later. He didn't pick well. She kept a 5.5 Red Hawk under her mattress. Just a .357, not a .44, but it did the trick.
Was there anything left of the guy?
Not much above the neck. Justice got done, but it would have been a whole lot cleaner if the CS kid had held on to the evidence. Taught me to treat it like gold. First, Cooper and Lincoln did a visual of the splinters and curlicues of bronze and other metals. Using an optical microscope on low power, Lincoln compared them with the scraps found in the backs of the women victims. He was looking at the shape of the scraps, along with the indentations from the tools that had trimmed them off a large piece of metal, presumably one of the sculptures.
Tool marks look real close to me, Lincoln said.
Lucas walked over to the high-def monitor plugged into the microscope via an HDMI cable.
Yeah, I agree.
They next had to compare the chemical composition of the metal from the crime scenes with that of the scraps Lucas had found at the studio. Cooper went to work analyzing each one, using the glow discharge spectrometer, the gas chromatograph, and the scanning electron microscope.
While we're waiting, Lucas said, pointing to a bag,
possible bloodstains from the floor near his bedroom. Cooper tested with luminol and alternative light sources.
Yep, we've got blood.
A reagent test confirmed it was human, and the tech typed it. The sample, however, didn't match the types of the women victims from the earlier scenes. They tested concrete samples that Lucas had collected, too, and compared them with the concrete particles found in the women's backs.
Close, Cooper assessed. No cigar.
Hell. Lincoln then glanced at the doorway. He'd heard the nearly undetectable sound of the key in the lock. A moment later, the female detectives walked into the parlor.
How did it go? Lily asked Lucas.
He shrugged.
Some evidence fell off the truck.
He nodded to the equipment, merrily analyzing away. He glanced at Amelia's outfit.
Damn, you need to go undercover more often.
Lily hit him on the arm. Behave.
Lucas then asked the women, what was Verlaine like?
Dangerous, Amelia said.
Lily filled in. He looks at you like you're naked and he can't decide what to lick first.
And then what to whip.
So the S&M hunch paid off?
Big time.
He's the S all the way, wants to be the herder, not the hurtee.
Lily explained about his personal Pinterest album.
Jesus, took all my willpower not to kick him in the balls.
You should have seen what he did to some of those women.
He pressure you two lovely ladies to go home with him? Lucas asked.
Sure, but we had to postpone our threesome. Somehow his glass kept getting refilled. He was in no shape to tie anybody up after that much bourbon. I was tempted to let the asshole stagger home and hope some mugger beat the crap out of him, but Amelia was the mature one and we got him into a cab.
Sachs glanced at the plastic bags.
What does the evidence say?
Just getting it now, Lincoln told her and grumbled. Right, Mel? Seems to be taking forever.
Mel Cooper, hunched over a computer monitor, didn't respond. He shoved his glasses higher on his nose and said,
interesting. That's not a useful term, Mel, Lincoln snapped.
I'm getting there. Lucas collected 5 different kinds of bronze from Verlaine's. One is a typical modern formula, 88% copper and 12% tin. Then alpha bronze with about 4-5% tin. Some other samples have a higher concentration of copper and zinc and some lead. That's architectural bronze. Others are bismuth bronze, an alloy that's got a lot of nickel and traces of bismuth. One sample surprised me. It had a Vickers hardness value of 200.
That's the bronze used in swords, Lucas said.
They all looked at him.
For the role-playing games I write, helps to know about old-time weapons. Roman officers had bronze swords. Foot soldiers had iron.
Amelia asked,
You think he uses bronze as a weapon?
Lucas shook his head.
No, I think what it means is that he gets his materials wherever he can find them. Probably from dozens of junkyards and construction sites.
I agree, Lincoln said.
Cooper added, and there's triethanolamine, fluoroboric acid, and cadmium fluoroborate.
That's flux, used in brazing and soldering, Lincoln said absently.
Okay, the big question. Any associations, Mel? Lucas asked. In crime scene work, very few samples of evidence actually matched, meaning they were literally the same. DNA and fingerprints established true identity, but little else did. However, samples of evidence from two scenes could be associated, meaning they were similar. If close enough, the jury could deduce that they came from the same source. Here, the team had to show that the shavings found in the first victim's bodies could be closely associated with those Lucas had collected from Verlaine's studio.
Cooper finally pushed back from the screen. He didn't seem happy.
Like the concrete, the flux and welding rods are close to the trace from the earlier crime scenes.
Lincoln's face tightened into a frown.
But those are used by anyone brazing, welding, or working with bronze. I want to establish identity with the bronze scraps themselves. Understood, but there's more of a problem. He explained that four of the bronze samples at the first crime scene were completely different from any of the metal collected by Lucas. One sample Lucas had collected that night had the same composition as several fragments in the first scenes. The others were similar, but had some compositional differences.
How similar? Lincoln snapped.
I'd feel comfortable testifying that it was possible the scraps embedded in the victims came from Verlaine's loft, but I couldn't do better than that.
The evidence suggested, but didn't prove, that Verlaine was the killer.
Same with his behavioral profile and his history of sex offenses, Lily added. The S&M, it's likely he's antisocial enough to kill, but that ain't enough to swing the jury.
That irritating little beyond a reasonable doubt requirement.
Lucas told the women about the mysterious door to the basement.
I'm betting there's something incriminating down there, but without a warrant, we're not getting in.
Cooper now put the pictures of the necklaces up on the high-def TV.
Trophies, I'm betting, Lucas said.
Crosses, mostly, Lincoln observed.
Well, that means there are seven or eight more victims out there. Nobody's found the bodies yet.
Or, Lucas said, that those are for Vix he's got coming up.
Lily said angrily, we've got to stop this fucker. I mean now.
Trophies, some evidence, a behavioral profile that's in the ballpark, Amelia summarized. He's got to be the one, even if we can't make a case just yet. But the good news is, if he's the one, nobody from the department is involved. Verlaine's just some lone psycho.
Wouldn't be too sure about that, Lucas said. There's another possibility.
Lincoln understood.
Could be that Narcotics 4 has been using Verlaine to torture and kill the women to get leads they could use.
Exactly.
Amelia scowled.
Sure. Verlaine's been a bad boy. Maybe somebody from the drug detail's been extorting him to get information from the women. That way the cops will keep their hands clean.
Lily sighed. I'll take the hit on this one. They looked at her.
We've got to tell Markowitz the news. A, we don't have enough evidence to collar our favorite suspect, and B, his world-famous drug detail isn't in the clear either.
She looked over her teammates.
Unless, of course, somebody else would rather have that little chat.
They all smiled her way.
We've caught another one, sir. Woman, 20s. It was 8:30 the next morning, and COD Stan Markowitz was sipping his first coffee of the day in one of the old-time containers, blue with Greek athletes on it. But hearing this news, he lost all taste for Java, and for the bagel sitting in front of him, too. It took a fuck of a lot for him to sour on walnut cream cheese. The chief of detectives snapped, "In her 20s or in the 20s?" The young detective, a skinny Italian-American, said, "She was 29, Latina, found the body in a vacant lot in NoHo." He was standing in the doorway, not in or out, as if Markowitz might decide to fling a stapler at him. It had happened before.
I don't like the name NoHo. It's not a real place. I can live with Soho, but even Tribeca is pushing it.
The kid didn't respond, but there was really nothing to respond to.
Crime scene's on it now, he said.
Markowitz stroked his round belly through the striped white shirt the wife had laid out for him that morning. He wadded up the oozing bagel and pitched it emphatically into the wastebasket. It landed with a surprisingly loud thud. This was the first entry of the morning.
T.O.D.?
Examiner's saying about midnight, the detective said. No specific leads yet. No wits. Same as the others. She was a user, crack and smack. Found in a lot known for drug activity.
He's a psycho, that's what he is. It has nothing to do with the drugs. Don't get that rumor started.
Sure, only...
Only what?
A hesitation at this.
All right.
Markowitz glanced down at a file on his desk. Red Hook Operation Classified. The NYPD had top-secret files, too. Langley has nothing on us, he thought.
That's all, Markowitz said. I want the crime scene report before the ink's dry. Got it?
Sure. The young detective remained standing. With a glare, the COD sent him scurrying. His landline had started ringing, six buttons lighting up like Christmas trees. One reporter, two reporters, three reporters, four. He glanced at the empty doorway and sent a text, then hit the intercom switch.
Yes, sir? Hold all calls.
Yes, sir, except that
I said hold. The commissioner's on, too.
Naturally.
Stan? There's another one?
The man didn't have a brogue, but Markowitz often imagined that Commissioner of Police Patrick O'Brien sounded like he just came off the boat from the old country.
Afraid so, Pat. This is a nightmare. I'm getting calls from Gracie Mansion. I'm getting calls from Albany.
His voice lowered and delivered the most devastating news. I'm getting calls from the Daily News and the Times. The Huffington Post, for heaven's sake. One reporter, two reporters. The commissioner continued.
The Vicks are minorities, Stan. The killings are bad for everyone.
Especially them, Markowitz thought. Then finally the commish wasn't wailing anymore, but asking a question.
What do you have, Stan?
A grave tone in his voice. Then,
it's pretty important that you have something. You hear me? Stan? I mean really important.
You have something. Not we, not the department, not the city.
Markowitz said quickly, we've got a suspect.
Why didn't anybody tell me?
But his voice was bombed with relief.
It happened fast.
You got him in custody?
No, but he's more than a person of interest.
The pause said that wasn't what the commissioner wanted to hear.
Is he the perp or not?
Has to be. Just a few loose ends on the case before we can collar him.
Who is he?
Sculptor, lives downtown, and the evidence is solid.
Listen, Stan, the commissioner said, back to whining.
There is way too much flack hitting the fan.
Patrick O'Brien would rather butcher a figure of speech than utter an expletive.
Make it work.
What, Pat?
Wouldn't the citizens of New York love to read that we have a suspect?
Well, Pat, we do have a suspect, just not enough for a warrant or an announcement in the press.
You said the evidence was solid. I heard you say that.
The citizens of the city'd feel so much better knowing that we're on top of it.
It'd be great if they could read that by the time the Times Online got updated in the next cycle,
which was about every half hour.
And I'd feel better too, Stan.
Despite the COD's dozen-year track record, the commissioner could drop him to a low-level spot in public affairs in the time it took to microwave a Stouffer's lasagna.
All right, Pat.
After organizing his thoughts, Markowitz picked up his cell phone, hit a number.
Rothenberg.
I just heard, detective. Another one.
That's right, Stan. We're at the scene. Amelia's running it now. The Vic was tortured first, just like the other ones.
I wanted to let you know you're going to hear in the press that we have a suspect. After a dense pause, Lily said, "Who?"
"Well, the sculptor, Verlaine."
"He's our suspect, Stan. He's not the press's suspect. There's a big difference. Verlaine's not for public consumption at this point."
"What does your gut tell you, Lily?"
"He's an asshole. He's a sadist, and he's the doer."
"What's the percentage?"
"Percentage? Christ, I don't know. How does 96 3/10% sound?"
The COD let the irrelevance pass.
"It's going to put people at ease, Lily."
Silence, presumably as she tried to process why they needed to put people at ease.
"That's not in my job description, Stan. My job is catching assholes and putting them in jail."
He looked up. He noted a woman in a suit standing in his outer office waiting. She was the one he'd texted 15 minutes ago.
Markowitz said, "And I've looked into your other theory."
"What's that?" she asked, an edge to her voice.
"What you told me last night, that somebody maybe from Narcotics 4 or someplace else in the department was using Verlaine to kill the women? Don't waste time pursuing that."
"Why not?"
Now his voice was hard as a metal file.
"Because, detective, I was profiling perps when you were getting your knuckles wrapped for mouthing off in class. Verlaine's a single operator. His psych profile is as obvious as the front page of the Post. Now make the case against him. Stat."
"What part are you missing, Stan? If you announce he burns his fucking apartment down, there's no evidence left and the case goes to shit. He gets off and goes on to kill somebody else."
"The thing about nut cutters is they sometimes cut any nuts in their path, not just the ones you want them to."
"Detective," he snapped, "you're going to hear on the news in a half hour that we have a suspect in the serial killing of those women. If that means you've got to get your ass in gear and work faster and harder, then do it."
Click. He looked into the outer office and nodded. The stocky woman was in her 40s, blonde, and with a dry complexion and eyes that suggested she'd never laughed in her life. Her clothes were dowdy. She looked around to make sure they were alone. Markowitz nodded at the door. Detective Candy Preston swung it shut. He whispered, "We've got some problems."
"I heard."
The woman was a nutcutter too, but she had the most melodious voice. He could hear her reading stories to children.
"I need you to move forward with what we talked about."
"Now? I thought we were taking things slow."
"We don't have the luxury of taking things slow."
The chief of detectives unlocked the bottom drawer of his desk and handed her an envelope. It was thick, but not as thick as you'd think. $50,000 in hundreds really doesn't take up a lot of space.
"I'll do it now," said Preston.
She was one of the senior members of the Narcotics Unit 4 detail. She slipped the money into her purse and rose, walked to the door. Her feet, he noticed, were as delicate as her voice. Just before she touched the knob, Markowitz said,
"Oh, some advice, detective?"
She frowned at the implication that she was green. Stiffly, she said,
"I've handled things like this in the past, Stan. I know."
"That's not my advice. My advice is don't fuck up."
Amelia was switching back and forth between WABC and WNBC and said, before anyone else did, "We're screwed."
"Maybe," Lucas said.
He turned to Lincoln. "I understand from my BCA people that fires mess up DNA."
"That's right," Lincoln said.
"Theoretically, if he dumped a few gallons of gas down that basement, if the basement is the kill room, he could wipe out the most critical evidence. We wouldn't get DNA unless we found an actual body."
Lucas said to Lily,
"You know what I think? If those are trophies hanging on his wall..."
"They are," Lincoln said.
"Then we're dealing with a lot more than four dead.
Even if we don't have what we need for a search warrant, we need to go in there anyway."
Lily shook her head. "We need a warrant."
Lucas turned to Lincoln. "Help me out here."
Lincoln said, "We took samples from the poured concrete steps outside the building for which we didn't need a search warrant, and we found that the concrete matched the flecks of concrete in the victim's backs. We also found flecks of bronze, which are chemically identical to the bronze found in the victim's backs."
"But,"
Amelia said. Lincoln raised his hand.
Quiet.
That's certainly enough for a warrant, Lily said. At least if I go to the right judge, and I will, if you'll write out the specs for the application, I can have it in an hour.
I'll do that, Lincoln said. And to Lucas, if you'll go back to the building with a couple of collection pads, get those samples for me. Backdate them to this morning. There may not be any bronze, but we've got a fair collection of it now. Take a few flecks with you, you know, just in case.
They all looked round at each other, then Lucas said, at least a dozen trophies.
After you make the collection, just wait there, Lily said. I won't be long behind you.
I'll go with Lucas, Amelia said, if we need to block the back of the building or he needs backup while we're there.
You might want to bring an entry team, Lucas said to Lily.
Entry team? I'm bringing everybody. I'll make a courtesy call to the FBI. They'll want to have an observer.
I'll be there, Lincoln said. I don't want your entry team trashing my evidence.
They took Amelia's car, a maroon 1970 Ford Torino Cobra, heir to the Fairlane, kicking out nifty 405 horsepower with 447 pounds of torque. They made the 20-minute trip in 12 minutes. 8 minutes out, she looked at Lucas and said, you're not holding on to anything.
You know what you're doing, he said. You're almost as good as I am.
She snorted.
What do you drive?
A 911. I always heard. She paused in her comment to chop the nose off a town car as she took a left turn. That 911 drivers have small penises? I know. Every time I meet somebody who can't afford a 911, I get the small penis line. So I ask them how large a sample they've looked at. She grinned as she said, I'll tell you what, though, in a fair run, I'd eat your 911 alive.
I don't like the word fair, Lucas replied. Fair always means to my advantage. If it's not to my advantage, it's unfair.
If you guys ever get to Minneapolis, bring your car. I've got a run just across the border in Wisconsin. Narrow blacktop, blind hills, 20 miles long, maybe 200 braking curves.
That's not fair, she said, but she grinned again and threw the Cobra down an alley, the walls whipping by 2 feet away on each side, 6 inches from Lucas's window when she dodged a trash can.
Lucas yawned and said, wake me up when we get there.
He tilted back in his seat and then said, by the way, I'm one of the best action shooters around.
Amelia dropped off Lucas, who was dressed in jeans, a polo shirt, and running shoes at Verlaine's apartment. He was carrying a backpack loaned to him by Amelia. There were four men on the long block, two on each side, each one by himself. Amelia was headed around the block where she could watch the back of the building. Lucas sat on Verlaine's stoop. He was too well fed to be a street person, but from a distance, with the pack by his feet, he could pass. They'd put a few bronze flakes in the bags with the sampling pads before they left, and now he took them out one at a time, trying to look like he was shaking cigarettes out of a pack, and pressed them into the stoop. When he had five samples in place, he put them in the pack and zipped it up. That done, he stood and ambled up the block, took out his cell phone and called Lily, Lincoln, and Amelia, and said the same thing to all of them.
We're good to go.
Lily said, 40 minutes.
What's taking so long?
Nothing. You just got there quicker than you should have. I've got the application. I'm seeing the judge in about 2 minutes, and the entry team is gearing up, so easy, boy.
Lucas continued up the block and onto the next block, and then walked back, and finally, with nothing at all going on at Verlaine's building, he turned the corner and walked around the block, where he found Amelia's car parked with Lincoln's Chrysler van right behind it.
Amelia climbed out of the passenger side.
Want to leave the pack?
Yeah. He looked at his watch. Half an hour yet. I'll find another place to sit.
Stay in touch, Lincoln said from the back.
Lincoln's aide, Tom, who was driving, said, I brought some sandwiches along. These two can spend hours at a crime scene. If you want a ham and cheese.
I not only want one, it'll give me something to do while I'm watching, Lucas said. Some reason to be sitting there.
Lucas ambled back around the block, carrying his brown paper sandwich bag, and found a stoop 50 yards down the block from the entrance to Verlaine's studio. He sat down, took Tom's ham and cheese out of the sack, took a bite, and said aloud, "That's a great ham and cheese." He was thinking about the fact that you almost couldn't buy a great ham and cheese in the Twin Cities, and why that might be, but that you could get a great one in Des Moines or Chicago, and then thought about Chicago being the hog butcher to the world, when a man stuck his head out of the door behind him and said, "This look like a fucking cafeteria? Hit the road, asshole." Lucas chewed and swallowed, then shook his cell phone out of his pocket and dialed Lily, ostentatiously pushed the speakerphone button, and when she answered, said, "I'm being hassled by a guy across the street from the Target at 219. How long would it take to get, say, a half dozen building inspectors here? The place doesn't look so sturdy." "I could have them there in an hour," Lily said. Lucas looked at the guy in the doorway. "An hour good for you?" "Stay as long as you want," the guy said, and eased the door shut. 5 minutes after that, a white van drove by Verlaine's building, and the guy in the passenger seat took a close look at Lucas and then nodded to him. Lucas nodded back. The van reappeared another 5 minutes later, going in the opposite direction, and this time the driver nodded to him. 10 minutes after that, Amelia called. "We got the blocking squad here. Lincoln and I are coming around." "And Lily." "1 minute." The entry team arrived in two white unmarked vans, closely followed by Lily in an unmarked car, another unmarked car, Amelia's car, and two patrol cars. Behind them all, Lincoln's van turned the corner. Lucas jogged down the street toward them as the van stopped directly in front of Verlaine's stoop, and two guys carrying an entry ram hustled up to the door. Four cops in armor were right behind them, and as Lucas came up, the ram handlers smashed the door open, and the armored cops went in. Lucas was right there with Lily, and as they piled into the entryway, the team suddenly stopped. There was some milling, and the team leader called, "We got a body!" Lily and Lucas shouldered their way from behind through the crowd, with Amelia a step behind, and they turned the corner at the door that went into the studio. Verlaine was there, staring sightlessly at one of his sculptures. His head was a bloody mess, and a semi-auto pistol lay on the floor by his fingertips. "Got some brass," Amelia said. She sounded like a professor of murder, her voice cool and analytical. Lucas saw the shell sitting by Verlaine's foot. Then Amelia turned to the entry team leader and said, "We've got to clear the building, but just two guys on this floor, and stay out on the perimeter, away from the kill site." The team leader nodded and started calling names. Lincoln pushed through the crowd in his chair, saw the body. Lily said to him, "This could solve a lot of problems." "Yes, it could," he said, "but the statistics say that it probably won't." "What do you mean?" "Serial killers don't often commit suicide. They like the attention they get from us. The spree killers, who are going through a psychotic break, they'll kill themselves almost every time if you give them a chance." "It's either a problem or an opportunity," Lincoln said.
"Opportunity?"
"If he didn't kill himself, it's a problem," Lincoln said. "If he did, I might get a nice paper out of it." "How bad is it, Sax?" Looking over Verlaine's apartment, she said,
"Seen worse."
She was speaking to Lincoln, who was outside on the street in front of the place. They were connected via a headset and stalk mic. Her judgment had nothing to do with the unpleasant detritus of gore and bits of bone littering the sculptor's floor near the body. In fact, head wounds produce minimal blood flow. What she meant was that the place was relatively uncontaminated. If scenes were left virgin after the crime, forensic teams would have a much easier time processing the evidence.